This episode is also brought to you by Play Ventures. Now, Play Ventures is the premier early stage VC fund that invests into gaming and gaming service startups around the world. We, and I do mean we because I am a part of the Play Ventures team, we invest early into the most promising mobile and PC free-to-play game studios and game service startups that are looking for more than just money. The fund is investing globally in Europe, Asia, and North America, expecting to make between 6 to 8 new investments per year. Our typical first investment into a new company ranges between $500,000 to $1 million, with the capacity to follow on into the future financing rounds. The partners meet and evaluate hundreds of companies per year and invest in only the best teams with the highest potential. Our goal is to help ambitious entrepreneurs create the next top of the food chain gaming companies around the world. In the teams we invest, we expect passion for games, raw talent, and most importantly, humbleness and team play. We love driven founders who dream big and want to be there to help you achieve those dreams, no matter how ambitious or crazy they may seem. If you're a new game studio or a game service startup, or somebody who's thinking about having a new game studio or a game service startup, looking to funding or some advice, please connect with us. Go to PlayVentures VC for more info on the fund, our team, and the investments we've made so far. That's playventures.vc. Deconstructor of Fun podcast is also brought to you by App Annie, the leading global provider of mobile market data. Now, personally, when it comes to exploring the market and creating a winning mobile strategy, I do it all with App Annie. Track top charts and rank history, get download and revenue estimates. App Annie also helps me to understand detailed usage data of my competitors' games. And if you're on the marketing side, App Annie is there for you as well. It helps you to understand what is it you need to do to increase discoverability of your games and how you should improve your advertising strategy. Combined with unparalleled service and support, there's really no reason why you shouldn't be using App Annie. So go to appannie.com and sign up. Tell them that the friends from Deconstructor of Fun sent you. Hey folks, and welcome to the first episode of our mobile publisher series. Now, in each of these episodes, we sat down with the CEOs of top mobile publishers and discussed on how they approach publishing. What is it their company's strategy, and like how is it set apart, and how do they work with developers? Also, how do they see the future of publishing on mobile? In this episode, I'm joined together with JK, we're joined with by Scopely's co-CEO, Javier Ferreira, who dives deep into the company's product strategy, organization, and team structure, as well as talks about the company's technology platform. We also discuss Scopely's mindset to launching new games and their attitude towards both original and IP games. I think this was one of the most interesting discussions on the podcast, and I'm happy to say that this episode will be followed by at least as interesting episodes on mobile publishing. So guys, stay tuned, remember to comment, and please do subscribe to hear the upcoming episodes with other CEOs from top-notch mobile publishers. Welcome everybody, and we're here with, as always, JK, and we have a special awesome guest, Javier Ferreira. Did I pronounce it correctly?
Pretty nice, yeah, pretty accurate.
All right. Awesome. Awesome to have you here or there. We're doing this remotely.
Yeah.
And we're going to talk about mobile publishing. And what's the better way to kick off our series on mobile publishing than to talk with the biggest mobile publisher out there, Scopely. But before we dive into Scopely, I'd like to, you know, Javier, I look, you know, your background in games is extensive. So can you tell a little bit more about your background and how did you end up at Scopely?
Sure. I studied in kind of mobile games back in 2002, right at the beginning of mobile content. You know, these were kind of black and white phones, pixels. But even then, we started to do games, browser games, SMS games, and it was clear to me from kind of day one that that mobile was going to be the kind of dominant gaming platform. Just because the level of access was totally kind of totally different level compared to the kind of platforms of that day, console and other kind of platforms. I then kind of moved to a company called Jamdat, which was a probably the most successful Western games publisher before the kind of iPhone era. I moved to London and I was running Jamdat Europe based out of London. Was there for about 2 years. After about 2 years, we got bought by EA, and that was about a $700 million acquisition. We, it was a kind of an exciting and fun time. We took all of kind of EA's IPs and really mobilized them into the mobile space, Sims, FIFA, Need for Speed, Simpsons at the time, Harry Potter. We really built a kind of fun and exciting business. And so I was running all of that kind of European business out of London. I was there for about 3 years. After that, I decided to take some time off. I actually took a whole kind of gap year, which was good and exciting. A lot of kind of great memories from that year. I stayed in Spain for a little bit after that. And in 2011, a guy called John Pleasants, who had been the COO of kind of EA, had moved over to Disney Interactive to really try and build the vertical kind of game business for Disney. I moved to LA in 2011 to work at Disney Interactive, heading up publishing, games publishing. There I was working on the console side of things and mobile and some online on console. I was heading up publishing for Disney Infinity, which was, which became Disney's biggest kind of console game, over $1 billion in revenue and, a very successful one on the kind of first iteration. And then on mobile, we kind of drove the transition to mobile free to play. When I came, it was all paid downloads. And we started, moving towards free to play. We did a number of games like Frozen, Marvel Avengers, Star Wars Commander, and other games that were kind of pretty successful. And so drove that kind of transition. I joined Scopely because obviously I had a lot of kind of experience in the mobile space and in the kind of mobile publishing space. And I was looking at the ecosystem and I felt that there was nobody attacking the space or building the type of company that I wanted to build. I think at the time, Scopely had been set up in 2011. They were a very kind of tech driven company. They were kind of building something pretty interesting on the kind of platform and technology side of things. They had some products, some revenue, and very interesting kind of set of talent. And I thought that we could kind of take all of those ingredients and build something really powerful and something very unique. So that was exciting. And so in 2014, I moved over and, started the journey.
Mm. And you started off as heading publishing at Scopely, and now you're co-CEO, if I'm correct. What does co-CEO mean?
Sure. I actually joined kind of Scopely as the COO. And co-CEO basically means that, Walter and I really try to kind of think about and operate the business together. I think what we have found is that through that process, we enhance our thinking, we make our thinking better. We challenge each other's ideas, and that leads to, I think, kind of better ideas and better approaches. We make sure that we operate as a single kind of integrated vision. We have areas of focus where we kind of deploy ourselves. But always, from a kind of integrated perspective, and as mm-hmm. I said, an improved perspective because of the relationship and because of the partnership that we have.
Yeah. And as just looking, even if somebody looks at your backgrounds, your and Walter's, you have very different backgrounds. You're clearly of, gaming for the last 20 years and publishing and everything, and more entertainment, and then Scopely.
Yeah.
So, let's talk a little bit about, well, not a little bit. Let's talk about a lot about Scopely.
Yeah.
The company has raised $250 million. You have done several rounds, and the last one was whopping $100 million. Till date, you have released a little over 20 titles.
Yeah.
And probably around 250 million downloads if we're looking at App Annie or Sensor Tower.
Yeah.
But most importantly for anybody and everybody who's listening to this, you've grossed over 1 billion in lifetime revenues.
Sure.
And originally, as you were talking about Scopely back in the days, it was kind of known as this sort of With Buddies franchise. And there's still a couple of massive With Buddies hits like Dice With Buddies and Yahtzee With Buddies.
Yeah.
Since then, you know, the company has really flourished with some mega hits like The Walking Dead, Road to Survival. You got WWE Champions. You got Wheel of Fortune. You got Looney Tunes World of Mayhem.
Yeah.
And of course, Star Trek Fleet of Command.
Yeah.
So even looking at your grossing charts, the Scopely's grossing, apart from 2017, the company has significantly increased its revenue year by year. And then, you know, looking at this at 2019, you're already 70% higher revenue rate than compared to last year.
Yeah.
So, I mean, this is going to be the topic for most of it, but how do you do it? How do you do this?
The vision for the company is, you know, we're trying to build a, hopefully the definitive free-to-play games company in the West. You know, that's the vision. That was the vision, you know, from kind of 2014 onwards. That's what we always kind of designed and thought about in terms of kind of our goals and objectives. Mm-hmm. And in order to do that, we think we've been kind of fundamentally focused on three kind of components. One is building a studio ecosystem that is capable of delivering, you know, market leading, genre kind of leading LTVs. Mm-hmm. And we can talk a little bit about that later. The second kind of component is building a tech platform that has, you know, a number of kind of components that can allow us and kind of empower us to kind of monetize those kind of LTVs, those kind of game experiences in a way that is more sophisticated and more durable than our competitors or the other players in the space. And I think thirdly, we're also kind of very focused on building a kind of company operating system. And by operating system, I mean our processes, our culture, our talent, that operates that studio ecosystem and that technology platform, again, in a way that leads to kind of, you know, market leading outcomes. And when you kind of put those three things together, and when you put those three things together in a kind of successful manner, you know, I think we have been able to build, launch, and monetize free-to-play games in a way that I think very few companies have done over the last kind of 4 years. And, you know, you talk about a kind of portfolio. And, you know, one of the things that's kind of unique about our portfolio is the fact that we've been able to do, you know, to launch very successful games across multiple genres, right? We've been able to do that on the casual side. On the RPG side, we've been able to do it on the kind of strategy side. And I think, you know, there's very few companies that have been able to do that. And so it is the combination of those kind of three components that drive our strategy, and I think they are differentiated. Each of them is differentiated in its own way, and together I think give us, you know, significant competitive advantage that has allowed us to kind of drive a lot of growth. You know, we're doing we've grown a lot. We're doing, you know, well over, you know, $400 million run rate now, and you know, we expect to kind of grow significantly over the next 12, 24 months. So it's been an exciting trajectory. But those three kind of fundamental buckets, I think, are the things that drive our company.
Got it. So so going into like the first part, the studio ecosystem.
Yeah.
Do you make games out of your HQ? And everybody probably saw the photos of your HQ. So it's a wholly new rebuild, Culver City HQ, and you can clearly see it from the images. So
on it.
So do you do games out of the HQ, or do you do games only through the external studios like Digit is sure. working on the Star Trek and so forth?
Yeah, I think the you know, taking a step back for a second to understand really our model. The way that we think about our kind of content strategy is that first we build a strategy, right? Mm-hmm. And by that I mean, what are the kind of genres and products that we want to kind of build? In some cases, what are the IPs that we think are kind of exciting? In some cases, what are the studios that we want to work with? But there is a kind of highly sophisticated, highly data driven kind of content strategy that drives our thinking around the kind of games that we want to kind of make. We are not a distributor of third party content. Mm-hmm. We are not a publisher of third party content. We are a kind of games company that is building what we think is a highly sophisticated content or game slate that we think maximizes our kind of strategic and revenue footprint in the market. Okay, so that's kind of where it all starts. And then once we kind of have those ideas and build those strategies, the kind of next step is, okay, how do we maximize the probability of success? How do we get behind a bet like, hey, let's make a strategy game because we think strategy games are, strategy category is exciting. How do we maximize the probability of success? And there, one of the components is studio, but really the way that we think about it is not in terms of studios or internal, external. The way we think about it is in terms of the franchise team. In order to kind of be successful, you have to build a franchise team. In this case, let's kind of use it as an example, the Star Trek kind of franchise team. And that team needs to have a set of capabilities in order to kind of be successful. One of the capabilities that it needs to have is development expertise in the strategy category. And in that case, because, for example, we did not have those capabilities internally, we go and kind of strike partnerships with studios, in this case Digit, and that's kind of what drives our thinking. In some other cases, as we do have those capabilities internally, and therefore we do have kind of internal studios, both in our kind of headquarters here in LA, also in our offices in kind of Barcelona, where because we think we have the capabilities internally, then the right kind of approach is to build that game internally. So it is driven by the kind of by the strategy, the content strategy that we're executing against. And then based on that strategy, we look for the best studio to execute against that opportunity. In some cases, that's an internal studio. Some other cases, it's an external, it's an internal studio. But in all cases, what we are trying to do after that is eliminate the kind of internal, kind of external kind of component and build a single kind of game team that is 100% focused on delivering the product outcome. And that game team, in most cases, includes people that are employed by Scopely. So you'll have game designers, you'll have product managers, sometimes you have technical directors kind of working on the Scopely side, partnering with the studios. And by the way, the studio might also have designers and product managers and engineering leadership that complements the talent that we have. And it is bringing together an amazing team from sometimes multiple, different companies that we think leads to market kind of leading outcomes. I think I see time and time again companies trying to do things that they don't know how to do, and that is sometimes it works, but more often than not it doesn't. And so we are conscious of the things that we know how to do really well, and also of the things where other people know potentially how to do it better. And we are partnership oriented, and we are open to kind of finding the right partnerships to complement our skill sets so that we can deliver, great outcomes.
Love it. This is really clear. So, like the way I hear it is you're quite more proactive versus reactive, which is a lot of, as a publisher, some publishers tend to be more reactive because they look at what's coming down the pipe and they're trying to, see what they can promote, where make an extra buck and so forth. But you're actually looking at first the landscape.
Yeah, that's a nice kind of way of putting it. We are also very proactive in reaching out to studios. You know, we are all the time speaking to what we think are the best kind of independent studios out there, and not because at that particular moment we might have a game that we want to make with them, but because we know that perhaps in 6 months, 12 months, 18 months, we're going to have an opportunity. But yes, we are kind of very proactive in building those relationships. And then we are very proactive in building a kind of content strategy and then striking the right partnerships to execute against that.
Mm. So, a couple of questions regarding that. So how big is the company as of today? If we're looking at, both the studios that you have and then your internal ones.
Yeah. So we're about 400 people, across, LA, Dublin, and Barcelona. And then we have another kind of 400 people across our studio ecosystem of studios that we don't kind of fully own. And in some cases, those studios are studios where we have investments, sometimes kind of investments to path, on a path to kind of majority ownership. In some cases, we have exclusive kind of arrangements. So all the kind of relationships with the studios are somewhat different. But yeah, it's about kind of 400 people across our studio ecosystem.
Mm. And how many studios? Like looking at your portfolio, as you said, it's extremely wide. So how many studios do you need to cover basically the whole gaming market?
Yeah. Well, right now we have 10 game studios, distributed all over the world, between kind of internal and external. I don't think that allows us to cover the whole gaming market yet. So we're always kind of, building additional partnerships. But that's kind of where we are today. And, our goal also with those studios is to go deeper and continue to kind of, further alignment, as we think about the kind of long term and about the partnership.
Yeah. Okay. 10 studios. That makes sense. Yeah. And you mentioned how many work. It's kind of like 50-50, like 400 and 400. And as a last question, I need to get JK into talking about mobile publishing, but I want to ask you about something you mentioned in the beginning and something that you said the Scopely was originally seen more as a technology company. So what do you mean by that? And what type of technology do you have technology do you support?
Yeah, and I think we think of our kind of technology platform as one of the kind of big drivers of our success and strategic advantage. I see the space today as on the one hand, you need to have the kind of studio and the kind of product know-how to build, extreme KPIs, but then you need to have the technology and the kind of tools to really kind of operate and monetize those kind of KPIs. And so, I think we're building a kind of pretty powerful, and we have been building a powerful kind of technology platform over the last 5-6 years. I would describe it as kind of three kind of fundamental buckets. On the one hand, we have all the kind of game engines that we have been building and that we're iterating on these days, and those are getting better every time, and I think on a path to leading to a large larger and larger outcomes. And as you can see, every year we deliver bigger games. Then we have our kind of modular kind of game services, which basically means that when any studio, internal or external, wants to kind of build a game, game service architecture that you need in a free-to-play model are already kind of available and built for you. Things like tournaments, leaderboards, player ID, server architecture, etc., which is kind of really powerful because it really empowers studios to focus on player experience, to really focus on the game and not have to deal with a lot of the kind of technology that is required to kind of operate these games. And on top of that, it means that whenever we're kind of building a feature, for example, clubs feature or a leaderboard feature, it's a feature that immediately becomes available to every single game across the ecosystem, right? And I think that's a kind of powerful process and idea, because it really accelerates the our ability to iterate on our kind of game roadmaps and to kind of grow the LTV of our products. Mm-hmm. And then finally, we have are, you know, kind of publishing technology, and that is everything that has to do with data, with BI, with user acquisition, marketing automation, segmentation, machine learning, all the kind of capabilities that fundamentally allow us to acquire users on a one-to-one basis and really kind of customize the experience through the whole kind of life cycle and the whole kind of player journey on a one-to-one basis in terms of, you know, what are the events that they see, what are the, you know, the offers that they get, you know, understanding the parts of the game that they engage with the most and making sure that we react to that kind of data. Basically, it's a collection of technologies that allow us to, as I said, manage players on a one-to-one basis. Mm-hmm. And so the combination of that kind of platform, you know, allows us to kind of build games faster, grow LTVs much faster than some of our competitors, and then, you know, deliver what we call a kind of directed by consumer experience, right? Where the kind of player is able to kind of really build the type of experience that they want to have in our games, and we have the kind of technologies to basically empower the player to do that.
Mm-hmm. Wow, super extensive. So, So JK is next. I want to ask, like, before JK kicks off, like, one of the important things that comes into mobile publishing. Sorry, JK, I'm not. I want to, like,
go for it.
The interesting part about it is always like the biggest challenge that I always see is the revenue share, and the revenue share in combination with the modern user acquisition. So if you're a developer and you have your game out and there's a revenue share model with a publisher, you won't likely see any revenue in, I don't know, 12 months. That would be realistic, even with a successful game. And you're kind of seeing all the marketing dollars come in, and with the revenue share, it's getting attributed to allocation. And through that, even if you launch a successful game, it's really hard to keep that developer pushing forward when they're not seeing any return coming back. And even though they're trending in like top 50, top grossing, everything goes out between the partners and to the distribution channels. So that's kind of like maybe one of the key reasons why mobile publishing has been so challenging. And so JK, take it away. I mean, I've been hampering with all your questions, but.
All right. So, Javier, so digging more into the mobile game publishing model and specifically with Scopely, I think there are definitely a lot of common perceptions or misconceptions. And so it'd be great to kind of dig into, you know, exactly how you guys operate. But just to set the context, if we look at the history of mobile game publishing, at least from an external perspective, there's a lot of dead bodies out there, right? And so whether it's Nexon, Zynga, EH Lingo, Rovio, Activision, to name a few, there's a lot of companies that have tried external third-party publishing, but just really haven't had that sort of success.
Yeah.
And then there's sort of this view that only developers who kind of lack in success or need resources are seeking publishers. And so some of these developers may only be looking at publishers for whether it's money, IP, or for the user acquisition side. And then on the flip side, there are certainly some publishers who want to just sort of take as little risk as possible and put a lot of risk on developers. And so there's been kind of this you know, the history of mobile game publishing has been a little bit kind of complicated and not super successful. And so just thinking about what you guys have done and how you guys have been able to build up so much traction, can you talk about what you guys have been doing differently and kind of your model?
Yeah. I think you know, there are kind of obviously a lot of kind of things worth kind of discussing here. I mean, first of all, I think there is sometimes people talk about kind of mobile publishing, and it feels that really what they're talking about is mobile distribution, right? There is somebody that has a game and is looking for somebody to kind of distribute that game. I think that generally does not work. And the reason why it doesn't work is because there is not enough value being created in that partnership, right? I have a game. Now, if my KPIs are incredible, you know, do I really need somebody to distribute that product? And if my kind of KPIs are not incredible, then the publisher is not really going to be able to kind of do anything kind of meaningful. So I see that kind of relationship as a kind of low value kind of relationship, and therefore one that, to your point, has not kind of produced any companies of meaningful scale in the mobile space, right? So that's not what we do, right? What we do is as I said before, partner with world class talent to deliver from day zero. Outcomes that we believe have potential for for a lot of kind of market traction, right? And so the partnership is built around the mutual creation of value. We are kind of bringing capabilities both on the kind of product, technology, kind of marketing and publishing side of things from day zero to that partnership. And of course, the studio is also kind of bringing a lot of kind of capabilities to that kind of partnership from day zero. And it is by that kind of deep kind of combination of skill sets and know-how that together we can deliver something that is dramatically different from what each of those companies could do on their own. Right. And there the partnership is creating a lot of kind of upside and it works. But of course, you need a kind of certain kind of content strategy. You need a certain kind of company DNA. You need a certain kind of set of technologies to be able to do that. It doesn't just happen organically. And I feel like obviously there's very few companies in the space that have built that and have thought of the space in this way. To your point, I think what we see mostly are distributors, right. I think that's a kind of low value partnership.
Great, yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. And then also, just if I were to look at, just as an outsider looking at Scopely, yeah, in terms of the evolution of your model working with external third party, studios, it seems like there's been, at least the external views, there's been a shift since iUGO where it seems like you guys are now trying to more sort of partner with external studios, but with an eye towards acquisition and bringing those studios internally. Would you consider that a fair observation? And could you talk about whether there has been kind of a shift in terms of how you work with externals?
Yeah, I mean, as I said before, a goal when we strike a partnership is for that partnership to first of all, be successful, and second, to be, very, very kind of long-term. Right, that is our kind of ideal kind of scenario and our orientation, and so one of the things that one of the kind of mechanisms through which you can make a kind of partnership very kind of long term is through acquisition, right? Because that kind of that immediately aligns both kind of groups or both kind of teams 100%. So I think there is a natural kind of tendency in our model towards kind of acquiring the successful kind of companies that we work with, and to really kind of double down on the partnerships that are successful. So in the case of Digit, for example, obviously we've had a kind of very successful outcome with Star Trek, and that's something that we want to build on, that we want to invest in, and of course, acquiring the studio is a great way of ensuring that we have alignment. I think the other thing around kind of acquisitions that's kind of important, it's a little bit what Mishka was kind of commenting before. How do you create value for the studio, right? I mean, that is something that is really important for us because we're looking for win-win partnerships. We're looking for kind of partnerships where kind of both companies can have significant upside on success. Of course, one way of doing that is the typical kind of royalty model. That's the kind of standard model. I think we are trying to kind of create studio partnerships that I think are more sophisticated than typical kind of royalty kind of models. And one way of creating upside for the studio is through acquisition. And so in many cases, we think and we talk and we structure deals from day zero around this type of outcomes, right? It is not something that happens by accident. It is something that's kind of thought out and designed from the beginning, so that the studio can also have a lot of upside if it delivers a large outcome. So there is nothing that says that we have to kind of buy a studio that we work with, but certainly, to the extent that the partnership is successful, it's something that makes a lot of sense for us, because as I said, that kind of really aligns us for the long term, And as I said before, internal, external, that's not really what matters. It is about kind of, you know, working together in an efficient way and being kind of very aligned in terms of the objectives that we're chasing.
Got it. And yeah, it does seem that that level of integration and alignment does provide a lot of competitive advantage, just from my perspective, having worked in publishing for the last 4 years. But I think the other thing that was interesting that you mentioned earlier was the fact that you guys are also entering into many different sort of game genres.
Yeah.
And looking in terms of the market, it does seem like the more successful companies are the ones that have been, you know, really focused on a very specific genre, like, you know, as like a Jam City and Match 3 over a long period of time and kind of developing a lot of depth within a single genre. So could you speak to that in terms of how you guys have been able to, you know, compete in many different genres?
Yeah. I think, you know, we start from two kind of places. One is the kind of reading and the analysis of the marketplace. You know, what are the kind of genres and kind of games that we think are going to be successful in the future? And when we kind of do that kind of thinking, we're not kind of really putting the filter of what are the games that we have made in the past. We are much more kind of interested in the future and what we think is going to be successful in the future. That's the first thing. And I think the second thing is, you know, we are a games company. And there's a lot of people at Scopely that have the creative drive and the creative desire to kind of make all kinds of games. There are people here at Scopely that love kind of making you know, social PvP games, but there's also a lot of people here that make, you know, like making kind of hardcore strategy games. And so that is a kind of very powerful part of our company, you know, this kind of depth of kind of creative talent. And we are also kind of excited and, you know, about empowering our people to go after those opportunities. Now, once we have those two things, like, hey, I believe that there is a market opportunity and that we have kind of creative talent at the company that wants to go after that opportunity, you know, the way that we think about that is we do not want to be constrained by the capabilities that we have in-house. We want to have the opportunity to pursue that opportunity. And what we are disciplined in ensuring that we only do that if we have the right set of talent and studio to go after the opportunity. And I think by doing that and by being, you know, disciplined around that, what we have been able to do is to kind of expand to multiple categories successfully. Because I think actually, Joe, I think many of the companies that have been successful in kind of one genre,
yes,
also been pretty unsuccessful in others, right?
Yes.
I mean, you are only kind of talking about the successful kind of verticals, but most of them have tried to kind of go into other genres, because as a games company, given how big the space is, and as I said, because we are kind of ultimately kind of creative driven kind of entities, we don't want to be constrained by what we have done in the past, you know. But you need to be sophisticated in ensuring that when you go after an opportunity, you have the right talent and the right know-how to go after it. And we think that by doing that, over the long term, we can build a much, much kind of more vibrant company, a much more successful kind of company, and a company that that can kind of, you know, have a footprint across all the different successful dimensions of mobile games. And, you know, we are excited about that, as I said, from a business perspective and also creatively.
Got it. And then now talking about, so, you know, you mentioned you talked to a lot of different studios out there. Can you talk a little bit more about, so what are the specific types of teams that you're looking for? And are there certain types of developers that you actually don't want to work with relative to who you do want to work with?
Yeah. I think, you know, as I said before, we are, obviously this kind of business is constant evolution. And so, you know, some of our criteria, and we are in constant evolution as a company as well. So this is a kind of criteria that has evolved over time. I would say that today we are very focused on trying to work with studios that are very focused, if not obsessed, around a particular type of game, a particular type of experience. For example, in the case of Digit, they are, you know, they always said, we want to build, you know, the most successful strategy games in the West, right? And so they've always been obsessed about that. And we like that because we think that in the marketplace today, the path to winning is, as I said, to deliver very extreme type of KPIs. In the case of strategy game, it's, you know, very extreme kind of, you know, LTV. And in order to do that, you need focus, right? And you need passion against the kind of game experience. So we love those kind of studios that are saying, hey, we're going after the strategy category, or we want to build, you know, the best kind of match three games, or we want to kind of really kind of build the most kind of amazing kind of RPGs. And you know, studios that are willing to kind of stay very focused against that. That's the first thing. The second thing that we are, you know, interested in, or that we kind of really value, is I think kind of Mishka was also kind of referencing before, studios that are excited about kind of working under a model, right? And that are kind of excited about you know, what we are all about as a company and a kind of long-term vision. I think that's kind of really important. And that alignment, kind of day zero, is what leads to kind of huge outcomes. As I said before, we're not interested in keeping our teams and the kind of studios that we work with separate. We are much more interested in making sure that they function as a single company, as a single unit, right? Yeah. And so that is, you know, a kind of way of thinking that not all kind of studios necessarily share, and that kind of matters to us. And so that kind of alignment around the model and the goals, the goals, another kind of important thing. You know, I think we are not interested in making games that do, you know, $2, $3, $4, $5, $6 million a month. We're interested in making games that can have kind of real kind of blockbuster kind of potential. And again, that requires a certain kind of commitment to the product, to the timelines, that is not necessarily all kind of studio share. So those are the things that we look for. And in terms of the kind of things that we are kind of less interested in, as I said, are studios that are, you know, spread too thin, that are kind of trying to do too many things. You know, perhaps sometimes I think there are studios who are interested in making games, and that's fine, and that's, you know, super, you know, we obviously respect that, but we are actually interested in making, you know, highly successful games, and those are two different things, right? You can make an amazing game that is not a great business. We are interested in making amazing games that are kind of very successful businesses. So we look for studios that have that kind of orientation.
So just to, is that the specific sort of high level valuation framework that you guys use in, you know, trying to work with the studio? So I think you mentioned one was like the depth and level of specialization. Secondly, working within the Scopely model. Third, the potential for that game design or idea to have blockbuster potential. And fourth, in terms of having focus, is that the general high level framework for you guys?
Yeah, I think that's probably pretty accurate. I would add obviously quality and kind of quality of talent as a kind of really important one. We are not kind of looking to we're looking for studios that have already very high quality and that can deliver kind of market leading level. So yeah, those are some of the kind of components that I think matter to us. Yes.
Got it. All right, Mishka.
Awesome. All right. So let's talk about working with developers. And just to reiterate, I was writing stuff down. So basically how I would sum it up, just listening to you, Javier, is like Scopely does very extensive market research. It understands very clearly its own capabilities, what it can and can't do with the current resources. You have very active discussions with developers around the world. So, and you're looking for focused developers. You're looking for developers that are excited to work with Scopely, with a publisher, and you're looking for developers that are mature enough because, you know, well, working with a publisher takes a certain amount of maturity to make it happen. And most importantly, you're looking for developers that are able to deliver the type of quality that actually creates a blockbuster game.
You have
very active discussions with IPs. I mean, you're located in LA. That's where a lot of IPs are there. Yeah. And the day-to-day work is driven and owned by the franchise teams when it comes to that. So can we first talk about, you know, probably the second most interesting thing for any listener is like, what is the business relationship look like with the developers? And we don't have to go to exact deal structures, of course. We can, for sure, we can go to.
I'll tell you all of them,
Yeah.
I think the important thing here is that there's not a template, right? Mm-hmm. Every single team has different set of goals, different set of expectations, different things that they're trying to achieve. What we are, we are talent-oriented. That is, when we want to kind of work with the studio, what we try to kind of structure is a deal that, that, as I said before, aligns our kind of long-term interests as much as possible, and delivers the kind of value or the kind of things that the studio is looking for. And every studio is different. And so we are, I think, pretty flexible and I would say quite sophisticated in the type of deals that we structure. And as I said before, you know, one of the kind of key components there is that there has to be meaningful upside, of course, for the studio in success. And so there are many, many different tools that you can use to kind of deliver those, to deliver that. You mentioned before royalties, but you also have, kind of lump sum payments, success fees, you have kind of acquisitions, you have investments. There are a lot of kind of different ways that you can kind of align the two companies. And so I would say that every single one of our studio partnerships looks different, and we tailor the deals to their relationship. And I think that's kind of important. And then in terms of how that kind of franchise team works together, as I said before, a goal is to empower the franchise team to operate in some ways as a kind of mini company, as autonomous as possible. Every kind of game team is making its own kind of decisions around the kind of what the game should look like and what the game should feel like. And we are looking for deep integration between our kind of product and kind of publishing people and the studio kind of resources. And the ones that work the best, the partnerships that work the best are the ones that basically operate as a single game team, irrespective of what company each person works for. To the extent that you can eliminate that, then you achieve maximum kind of efficiency, maximum creativity, and the partnerships can become very, very powerful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's one of the most important thing in not only in publishing but in any kind of partnership is to align the end goals.
Yeah,
and that's I've heard a lot, and you know, in this industry, you hear a lot when talking about publishing deals or anything, and people are talking about like, can we do the Scopely model, which in other words means like everybody has a happy ending. It's widely referred as that, but so can we talk about a little bit about I wrote so many questions down here as you were talking. So one of the interesting things about this franchise team approach from developers from the studio perspective is the question is who has the final say? Of course, internally, your franchise team is probably the one that carries the ownership whether the game is successful or not. Does the franchise team also have the final say in terms of, you know, development of the game, or is it the game team and the development team? Naturally, I assume that mostly they're always aligned, but in case, who has the final say?
Sure. You know, again, just to kind of Mm-hmm. When I say franchise team, game team, for me, it's the same thing, right? It's basically the team that is building the game, and that team is made up of product managers, game designers, artists, art directors, engineers, et cetera, et cetera. As I said, some people work at one company, some other people work at another company, but together they kind of make up that kind of game team. Now, as with any game team, there has to be a person that is ultimately responsible for the kind of final decision. In Scopely, that is what we call a GM, you know, general manager here on the Scopely side. And that person is the person that kind of has the kind of final say on what happens. I think to the extent that needs to happen in a game team, that is probably an indicator of low probability of success. Because I think the best kind of games are built by people kind of getting in a room and kind of laying out product visions that might be in conflict and might be kind of challenging each other, but then kind of really being able to synthesize those into an integrated kind of view that leads to a huge outcome. I think to the extent that happens organically, I think you're on the good path. To the extent that there's got to be some kind of tiebreaker that needs to kind of drive that is not, in my opinion, super healthy. So we try to ensure that's how we make kind of creative decisions, and that it is ultimately the team that comes up with a unified vision that incorporates different sensibilities. You know, and as a company, we have been very diligent about making sure that we bring into Scopely a lot of kind of different product sensibilities, because all different kind of free play games companies approach the space differently. Rovio is different than kind of Machine Zone, and EA is different than Kabam, and Scopely is different from pretty much everybody. The point is making sure that we don't have single person dictating how we make games, but that we have tremendous amount of kind of talent density in any one game team, and those kind of people are responsible and tasked with creating a unified game vision. So that's how the best teams here at Scopely works, which means that there's no clear kind of owner, like a single kind of person that is kind of defining that. But yes, if it comes to that, there will be a Scopely GM that will drive that kind of final say.
Yeah, I perfectly understand that, and it makes sense. So let's talk about a little bit about the relationship before and after a successful launch. So
yeah.
Assuming that successful launch ends up with the studio being some kind of a permanent partner or a member of Scopely family, whether it's an investment or acquisition, how does that change in the sense? So what I'm basically asking is, like, before everything is great and everything just, going towards that direction.
Yeah.
Is it the way that you usually pay for development, or so? Like, what is the
sure?
Or is it the sort of like a milestone approach? And then once we get into the soft launch and numbers look good enough, we can actually scale it. It's global launch and everything is rosy afterwards. But what is the relationship like?
Yeah, I mean, I think we don't like kind of milestone development agreements. We think it's very difficult to predict when a product is going to have the right KPIs, and we think that tying financials and payments to milestones creates the wrong incentives around kind of chasing the KPIs that we're looking for. So we don't like that. Our kind of goal through development is making sure that the studio doesn't have to worry about anything other than making an amazing game, right? That is what we're trying to create from a kind of from a financial perspective, and even from a technology perspective, as I said before, right? It's like, don't worry about anything that has to do with technology or kind of financials. Just focus on building a great kind of game experience. After launch, well, if the product is successful, then I think there are a lot of kind of ways, as I said before, that we have of rewarding kind of studios. And I mentioned them before a little bit. You have royalties, you have bonus payments, you have kind of investments, you have acquisitions. I think that's the easier kind of part, and that's where, you know, the partnership can kind of really celebrate and share the upside of what we've created. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that was actually a really interesting part, because if I'm a studio, and what I'm hearing is just like, you know, like I just met a Santa Claus, because what it means is like I get the perfect financial security to work on the best possible game. So so if you don't go through the milestones, how do you set it up? Do you like how do you keep on reviewing and making sure that the project is going according to? Because I don't know what's your success rate, but mostly in like even in a great studio, it's about, you know, 25 to 20% of the games actually pass through development into soft launch.
Yeah, I mean, a success rate is much higher than that, dramatically higher than that. But we do have kind of, milestones as a company, right? We look at kind of products in kind of different points of development. We just do not kind of align financials for our studio partners around those milestones.
Got it.
As somebody that has kind of worked at companies that are kind of more milestone driven, when you do that, what happens is that everybody's trying to hit the milestones rather than the KPIs. And mm-hmm. we are not interested in hitting the milestones, we're interested in hitting the KPIs. And so we make sure that studios are oriented towards that outcome. But yes, of course, we have kind of, you know, development milestones. We have a green light process that looks at games in different phases. I think we have been very patient in developing these games. Star Trek will do kind of over $100 million in its kind of first 7 months of kind of being live, but still took us over 3 years to make that game, right? And of course, during those 3 years, there were some kind of great moments. There were also some kind of valleys, right? And so to the extent that we believe in the team and to the extent that we believe in the idea, we generally are kind of pro continuing development of a game, because I think if the team is good and the idea is good, it's just a question of time until you find the magic and that until you find the kind of right KPIs. As you see that we are capable of kind of launching games in a very short kind of timeline, Walking Dead being a great example, but we're also kind of capable of investing in products for a long time and then get those products to deliver pretty huge outcomes. Yeah.
Okay, love it. So basically what you're saying is, because you invest so much time in market research, in understanding the capabilities, both your internal and the capabilities of your partners, having, you know, very active discussions with pretty much all the developers. I mean, if anybody is working in business development and if they meet any studio that is independent, they know that studio is talking to Scopely. So that's just a fact. So you're definitely have your guys out there, or at least Henry is everywhere.
Yeah.
And and you have active discussion with IPs and you trust in your franchise teams, and kind of like that base works allows you to have much more risk tolerance when working with external developer, because you've done your homework. Am I correct with this?
Yeah, I think the homework never ends, right? It's like we are always kind of iterating and ensuring that we are adding whatever it is that we need to add to the game, to the team. I'd say it's fairly easy to make a game, right? And we all know that, because if you look under the App Store today, you will see that there's 100 games that have been launched today, right? It is not so easy to make a successful large blockbuster type of kind of outcome. That is much more difficult. And again, if you look at the charts, you'll see very few of them kind of being made on a yearly basis. Okay. And so we are, we're committed to those outcomes. That's why hit rate is kind of much higher than the kind of competition. That's why, you know, when we launch games, we have really high conviction around the outcome that we are kind of going to deliver. And that just requires kind of patience and commitment during the development phase. Yeah.
Got it. Oh, okay. Okay. I totally understand. So, as the last couple of questions from myself, and then Jake is going to talk about the IP, working with IPs and overall industry trends. So, you know, you kind of touch upon what you feel is successful developer. It's the laser focus, the depth of the talent and the ability to deliver quality. But let's talk about other part is like, what does it take to be a successful publisher? Apart from setting up goals that are, that are in line with developers and what does it take? What does it take to be a Scopely?
Yeah. Yeah. Again, as you know, we don't think of ourselves as a publisher. Mm-hmm. We think of ourselves as a kind of, free to play games company. And I think one of the things that you need, if you're going to be a successful, free to play games company is the ability to take, a product that, hopefully has, you know, very strong kind of player KPIs and then scale that product from an audience perspective. So, you know, the kind of go-to-market strategy and the ability to, work with platform partners, to invest significant amounts of capital and to do that investment in a kind of, you know, highly efficient manner through, performance marketing and other kind of marketing channels. That's the kind of first component that you need. The second component is being able to kind of really operate the game in a sophisticated manner. And so at that point, what you need is kind of deep data analytics, a great kind of data visualization and kind of BI tools. You need to be able to have a lot of kind of segmentation capabilities and kind of play communication technology that, as I said before, allows you to, tailor the experience to different types of players. You need to have amazing ad technology that can deliver a ad experience that monetizes, that is, you know, bug-free and doesn't kind of create stability issues for the games. You need to have kind of machine learning and kind of marketing automation capabilities that allows you to learn about player behavior and kind of iterate on the game experience based on kind of that learning. You need to have all of those kind of technologies to be able to really monetize over a long period of time those the core game experience. When those two things come together, that's a kind of very powerful outcome. And I think that the most successful companies in the space, and I think Scopely is a great example of that, are able to do both. Yeah.
Perfect. So JK, trends and IPs.
Yeah, and before talking about trends and IP, I just wanted to ask in terms of, some of your games and, you mentioned Star Trek Fleet Command, but can you also speak to, what are some of your best performing games right now and why have those specific games been able to achieve success? Like, what were the keys to success for those specific games?
Sure. So, I think right now, obviously, our kind of most successful game is Star Trek. That's a game that, as I said, is, it's going to cross $100 million in its kind of first, 7 months of being live, which is obviously, big achievement. And we have, we think that game is going to have a very kind of large and long kind of, life. So we're very excited about that. That game is, the success of that game is fundamentally driven by the amazing kind of player experience that the team has kind of built that is basically resulting in some pretty amazing, player LTVs and monetization KPIs. It's a game that has insane amount of player engagement. People are playing pretty much every day of the week. Hours per day are pretty pretty incredible. It's a game that has kind of really captured an amazing, very passionate audience, and it's delivering kind of some of the best KPIs that we have seen, you know, across our portfolio. So that's the, you know, that's kind of Star Trek. Our kind of second most successful game right now is the Dice franchise. You know, that's a franchise that has kind of generated, you know, well over $400 million in kind of revenue today. It's a game that's kind of generating over $100 million of revenue a year. It's a game that we started kind of operating in, 2011. And its biggest kind of revenue year is going to be 2019. So that gives you a sense of how also we think about products. We think of these products that can last forever if well operated and kind of well maintained. I think that product is the success of that product is driven by, you know, a very unique kind of player experience that I think nobody has kind of really been able to kind of replicate. It is a kind of, you know, core, you know, bonus, that dice roll you know, we're the kind of really the only game that is kind of doing that. And again, it's a game with, you know, very strong retention, very strong long-term retention, and a, you know, very kind of passionate kind of fan base. So those are kind of the two biggest games that we have at the moment. Both are, you know, over $100 million a year in revenue. Then we have, you know, Walking Dead, which we launched in 2015 and has been, you know, hugely successful kind of franchise for us, generated, you know, well over $300 million to date. And, you know, was the first time that we kind of entered the RPG space. We launched Looney Tunes kind of also at the end of the year, and you know it's kind of early days, but we're very kind of excited with the trajectory, you know, the trajectory of that product. And then we have also on the RPG space WWE, which is again generated over $100 million in revenue since we launched it in 2017, and again which we see a kind of very durable long term kind of franchise for us. You know, continuously engaging with the WWE fan base in kind of really kind of fun and interesting ways. And then the kind of smallest product that we have is kind of Wheel of Fortune, you know, which we launched in 2016 and end of 2016. You know, it's a kind of very strong evergreen IP, a lot of kind of organic installs coming to that game. And, you know, we're pretty happy with the performance of it.
Got it. And it seems like the recurring theme amongst all the successful games that you guys have been launching is IP. Can you talk to your strategy when it comes to IP? Are you guys just going to be doing IP-based games moving forward? And what do you see as like the biggest benefits of working with IP-based
games? Yeah. I mean, I think a focus there is not, it's not IP. We're not an IP-driven company. We're an audience-driven company. What we are trying to solve at the kind of product strategy level is, hey, we want to make games for large audiences. And I think, you know, when we were looking at the space, you know, back in kind of 2014, 15, 16, we thought that the most kind of predictable kind of path to doing that was through partnering with, you know, with IPs that already had, you know, very large kind of captive audiences. And the type of audiences that we're looking for are evergreen audiences, durable audiences that are kind of, you know, engaged with the IP in a kind of profound way. So, you know, things like WWE, things like Walking Dead TV show, you know, things like, you know, Wheel of Fortune also kind of on TV, right? You know, also audiences that are kind of perfect for the free-to-play space. So we tend to kind of, for sure, shy away from kind of kids' IP, and we're trying to kind of really deliver experiences for, you know, for adult players. You know, we thought that IP was a kind of very efficient and high probability way of ensuring that we had you know, a kind of path to systematic success. You know, as we said before, we're in the business of creating a kind of games company that can systematize launching and operating free-to-play games, which I think very few companies have done. And so we thought that was kind of an important part of our strategy. But there is nothing that is intrinsic. Like, there's nothing, we're not kind of necessarily 100% committed to IPs. To the extent that there are IPs that can help us achieve that, we will continue to invest in them. We think they're very kind of strong partnerships. Of course, the type of IPs that we are kind of interested in working with these days are really only the kind of IPs that can really aggregate large scale global audiences. But we are also kind of working on games that are not IP based. And as the kind of industry has kind of evolved to a more kind of performance marketing driven ecosystem, we think that to the extent that you can build games with the highest LTV in the category, then you can also, you know, build a very kind of loyal and large kind of audience through kind of large marketing launches and sustained kind of performance marketing. So, we are pursuing both. We will continue to work with IP holders that can kind of bring large audiences to our games, but we are also building, you know, original IP games where, you know, we have an audience strategy built into them from day one.
Got it. And then just given the wealth of experience that you guys have working with, big IPs and with IP holders, you know, there can definitely be some challenges working with some of those IP holders with respect to like IP approvals and things of that nature. Can you talk about what your experience has been and how you guys have managed some of the complexities dealing with IP holders?
Yeah. You know, I mean, I think in my experience, those conversations and those relationships have gotten much kind of, easier over time. I remember when I was at EA, for example, it was difficult. IP holders sometimes had a very kind of static way of how they wanted their kind of franchise or property to be reflected in the gaming space. Yeah. I think with kind of free to play, that has changed pretty meaningfully. I think with a kind of data driven approach to kind of game design and game making, I think IP holders what they want to see is that you're able. You're capable of building an experience that the fans of the IP are going to love and are going to really engage with. And the good news is that that is something that is measurable today, right? When we're kind of working on a kind of Walking Dead game, we can go to a kind of partner like Skybound and clearly show them that the creative decisions that we are making around their IP are, you know, creative decisions that the fan base and the player base are kind of really engaging with. And you can see that in the retention KPIs, monetization KPIs of the game, and so we have found that IP holders, at least in our case, have allowed us to take some kind of significant risks with their IPs. Have allowed us to perhaps kind of bring their IPs to the mobile space in ways that are not kind of not just a straight port of whatever exists in kind of other platforms. And we've seen, you know, very productive and exciting kind of relationships. It's not an area where we've had major issues. I would say that they have been kind of very productive partnerships and very data-driven partnerships.
Great. Yeah, I think that's great. You haven't had a lot of issues. I think generally, just from my experience, what I've seen is that on the developer side, generally the issue is all the restrictions, IP approvals, delays, and things like that. And then on the publisher side, it's like, well, you know, you mentioned Star Trek Fleet Command took 3 years. You know, I don't know who you worked with, CBS or Paramount or whoever may have, you know, had a revenue forecast for a certain time. And so when a game delays, they're like, you know, I'm sure they could get kind of antsy.
Yeah.
Over that.
Yeah. Again, look, I mean, I think this comes down to doing things well, right? If you don't do things well, then bad things happen, and that includes Scopely, includes a studio partner or an IP holder, right? So we make sure that we have the kind of right people and processes to manage a partner. You know, we decide to kind of work with a partner because we think that they're going to kind of create value for us, such as, you know, CBS in the case of kind of Star Trek. And we committed to that partnership, and that partnership has certain obligations, and we manage those obligations well. And around kind of timing of launches and things like that, you know, again, I think IP holders have become way more sophisticated over time. there is, you know, back in the console days, you made money by launching a game, right? You kind of spend a bunch of money and then you would go to kind of retail and you would sell a bunch of kind of discs and you would make money by doing that. As everybody knows, you lose a lot of money by launching kind of free-to-play game. And you only kind of make money to the extent that that is a great game that the fan base is excited about and willing to engage with it for very, very long periods of time. So being day-driven, it's not a viable strategy. It's guaranteed failure. And it's something that we established very clearly with the IP holders on kind of day one. We want to deliver quality. We want to deliver kind of we want to deliver on their IP, and we want to deliver kind of huge player outcomes and huge revenue outcomes. And that requires everybody to be aligned around that goal. And that is, by the way, the right goal if you want to maximize your revenue, if you want to maximize your royalties. Yeah.
Got it. So I just have one final question. So in terms of like emerging and future trends that are potentially going to be impacting mobile game publishing in a big way, what are your thoughts in terms of what some of these trends might be?
Yeah, I mean, I think what's obviously the kind of, I think the most kind of interesting trend that I see in gaming today is, you know, back in the kind of 2000s, something kind of interesting happened in the kind of gaming space, right? You basically had one kind of platform, which was Western console, and then the kind of games industry kind of like exploded, right? And then you started having, you know, deep, you know, very kind of exciting kind of you know, game ecosystem in Asia. You started to have kind of free to play, you know, versus kind of packaged goods. You started to have you know, online gaming, then Facebook gaming, then mobile gaming, and you know, there were all these kind of different ecosystems that in some ways existed kind of independently of each other, right? So you had console, you had online, and then you had kind of mobile, right? And you had kind of different geographies that seemed to kind of play you know, different games, and that's kind of where I think the industry was, you know, a couple of years ago. And I think what you're seeing now is all of those kind of different ecosystems imploding into a single ecosystem. That the way I think about it is kind of digital free to play, and you know, free to play has demonstrated that it is the kind of best business model for players and for publishers. You know, I think you'll see the kind of certainly from a kind of market share perspective, it will be the kind of dominant business model. And then you see that you know, games as a service type of kind of game making is also the type of kind of experience that allows you know, developers and publishers to deliver maximum value to players. And so I think you're also going to have, well, you're already seeing that, of course, in the kind of console space, but also online and mobile. And so all of those kind of platforms are kind of coming together. And it's an exciting time because you can now build, you know, build a game, build an experience that can go across multiple screens, that can kind of live across, you know, multiple, you know, player moments, if that makes sense. And I think that is going to require a different set of capabilities, and different ways of thinking about game design and, you know, and the kind of products that we build. So that's, I think, really exciting. I think it allows, companies such as us to reach, you know, a bigger audience, and to engage with players across, you know, across more moments of their kind of day-to-day life. So, that's exciting. I think from a studio perspective, it's gonna require everybody to kind of level up their kind of game making capabilities. You're gonna have to deliver experiences that can kind of play incredibly well across multiple device types, and yeah, that's a creative challenge for sure, as well as a technical one.
Great. Well, thank you very much, Javier. And Mishka, you've got some final words.
I mean, you can do those things. We always do some shout outs, and then in this case, I mean, definitely we want to give a shout out to Henry Lowenfels, who's always listening to this podcast. He's heading business development, I think, at Scopely. Yeah.
The most well-liked person in the mobile games industry.
Yeah, by far. You can meet him everywhere, and he talks to every developer, so he's like a one-man army.
Yeah, that's
I want to I want to also give a shout out to Scopa's Instagram channel. We were looking at that with Joe yesterday, and Barcelona had some amazing party.
we were talking about that as well. Yes.
I mean, you got the catamarans up in the sea and everything. So if you're not following that Instagram channel, you should most definitely add that to your list. Yeah. And probably like a few things from you, Javier, is like, where can, you know, you talked a lot about developers who you're looking to work with, and you're probably talking to all the possible developers. But if some developers are not yet in contact with the Scopely folk, where can they meet? Where can they meet you guys?
Well, I think Henry Lowenfeld, to your point, is the kind of person that leads those kind of efforts here at Scopely. You know, obviously he is, his email is henry@scopely.com. I hope he gets a lot of kind of emails over the next kind of few days. But you know, he's obviously present across all the kind of, you know, major kind of game gatherings. He'll be at Gamescom, and as I said, we are not a company that speaks to all developers. We are kind of focused on what we think, you know, who we think are the kind of the type of studios that can deliver, you know, really, really high LTV games. But yeah, for sure, always interested in companies that can help us grow, that can, you know, teach us things that we don't know, and that can bring capabilities that expand, you know, the set of things that we can do as a games company.
Mm. And finally, I'm sure everybody enjoyed listening to it, and we enjoyed talking to you. So where can the listeners see you talk next time? Are you talking at certain conferences, or where can they see you?
I don't know the answer to that kind of question right now, you know, I'll certainly try to kind of make an appearance in that Instagram channel as soon as possible.
All right, so follow the Instagram channel, and Javier will know what Javier will be talking at next.
Yeah.
So thank you for both of you for Joe for, you know, setting up this, and Javier for really in-depth answers. You didn't shy away for any of the questions, and Joe and I wrote everything we could think about, some critical, some you know, some questions that we just really wanted to answer, and you didn't modify or do anything about it. So that's always huge props.
No, thank you. I mean, look, I think what I find is that we are a kind of company that doesn't kind of follow the traditional kind of some of the traditional kind of ideas or models that kind of people have around, you know, mobile games. And so I think this was a great kind of opportunity for us to go into a little bit more depth in kind of explaining our model and ensuring that, you know, people have an opportunity to understand how we think about the space, how we think about us as a company, and, you know, how we think about working with studios. So thanks for the opportunity.
Perfect.
All right. Thanks very much, Javier.
Awesome. Bye-bye, guys. Thank you.
Thank you. That's it.